Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Michigan leads the nation in small business loans. That seems like good news on the surface, but are there economic consequences for so many new startups? Then author and poet Keith Taylor will stop by to give us his picks for summertime reads, and his choices might just surprise you. And then we end the hour with pie. We'll find out how one couple is trying to bring goodness to communities by pieing it forward.
People are usually a bit skeptical at first. I guess free food is kind of unusual no matter what kind of food it is. But then we generally win over the crowd, and the pie can be gone in anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour.
But first, some great news today as we welcome Interlochen Public Radio listeners to Stateside. Listeners from Traverse City to Manistee, Harbor Springs to Ludington, all joining in on the conversations and issues that matter to all of us as Michiganders. Together, we'll explore breaking news and we'll better understand policy issues. And we'll discover stories and meet people from every corner of our state. And as always, we want to hear from you here at Stateside. Let us know what you want to hear more about. You can easily find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, you can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. We really look forward to you joining in on the conversations that matter in Michigan. So let's begin our hour with politics. That's as Governor Snyder continues traveling around the state today in southeast Michigan, pushing for an expansion of Medicaid. Governor Snyder wants to expand the program using federal funds to hundreds of thousands of low-income adults. The governor has criticized fellow Republicans in the Senate for leaving Lansing for their summer recess without voting on the measure. The State House had already approved the legislation. Governor Snyder joins us now. Governor, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's great to be with you. And this is an important topic, so I appreciate it.
Well, Governor, Senate Republican leader Randy Richardville announced a group of senators will hear testimony on the expansion of Medicaid this week, but a vote's not expected. Is that enough movement on the issue in your eyes?
Well, the good part is it's positive movement, and that's what we need to keep up. So it's a starting point. So I appreciate the work group meeting, and also they're going to do a committee hearing. So we are seeing progress. I'm just encouraging our citizens, though, to continue staying in touch with our senators until we get it done, because we need to get this done quickly and efficiently. It's all about making Michigan a healthier and better place.
Now, there has been some talk among your fellow Republicans that they don't want to vote on expanding Medicaid without giving this all plenty of time and thought and debate. And yet, as the entire state saw, a really controversial issue, which was right to work, was passed in mere days last December. Is this kind of a disingenuous argument, do you think, that we're hearing from the GOP?
Well, again, I don't view this as partisanship. We just need to encourage the senators to get this done. I brought this concept originally back in February. So it's been out there a significant amount of time, and I understand this is a complex issue, but this is a lot of good work's been done with the House, for example, that was strong bipartisan support to pass Healthy Michigan, and I just hope the Senate will look at it promptly, efficiently. Hopefully they can find some opportunities for improvement, but let's get it done this summer so we can move forward.
And you say you put that out there in February, so are they just taking way too long to tackle this and to make a decision?
Well, I would prefer to get it done, and I would have preferred to have gotten it done already, because this is something that's going to take some hard work and some time to work with the federal government, make sure we can put it in effect on January 1 of this next year. So there's a lot more to be done than just the legislation. So again, let's get the legislation done so we can move on to next steps. I'm ready to do that hard work. I'm ready to go.
Governor Snyder, you know, when your office is saying that our state could save more than $200 million in 2014 if the measures passed, with that in mind, why do you think there is such opposition to doing this? Why has the Senate been so slow to act?
Well, again, I don't want to speak for them, but one of the issues you do find, though, is anything associated with the Affordable Care Act has been very polarizing in our society for the last few years. And the point I want to make to the senators and all the general public is there are a lot of challenges with the Affordable Care Act. The number of the negatives are coming to Michigan with or without Healthy Michigan in terms of additional taxes going to Washington, additional cutbacks to health care providers. Those are all here without Healthy Michigan. Healthy Michigan is the one positive because it's doing it a smarter way than the vanilla federal program. It's actually encouraging wellness, personal responsibility by people in this program to get them out of the ER, get them some frontline health care so they can hold jobs better. They can be more productive in terms of their quality of life and what they can do with society. We all win from Healthy Michigan.
Well, we know that this is something you're very passionate about. You're traveling the state. You cut that overseas trip to Israel short to come back and lobby for the Senate to pass this. And you've also said, Governor, that you aren't willing to horse trade to get things you want passed in the legislature. And I'm just wondering, at a certain point with an issue like this that you feel so strongly about, is there a point where you're willing to make some deals or some compromises to get this thing done?
Well, it's always about working together, and that's where the House did good work. And I want to compliment the House on improving the legislation from what we started with in terms of bringing it more personal responsibility and wellness. So I hope there's an opportunity for the Senate to contribute some ideas. We just need to do it effectively so it can be something that works well for all Michiganders, that we can have enough time to work with Washington on getting it approved. So, again, I hope through this process, even with the delay, we'll get a better product. Well, let's get a product as quickly as we can because, again, we need to be able to implement it effectively so we can see the great results to our hardworking people in our state.
But are you willing to give something if the Senate Republicans want it?
Well, again, I don't view it as just going back and forth over something else. It's like, let's focus on helping Michigan and see if there's some improvement ideas that they can bring to the table. Please do, but let's do it promptly and effectively.
Now, Randy Richardville is saying a vote on the issue he figures is likely by September. Would that be enough time to iron out the details with the federal government in order to get this thing happening?
That's one of my concerns. I believe that could be very challenging, and that's why I've encouraged him to get something done this summertime. So July would be better than August. August is much better than September. So the sooner the better, and that's why I'm encouraging our citizens to do it in a respectful fashion, but contact your senator and keep contacting him until we get this done, because this needs to be a top priority, because we're talking about the lives, the well-being of over 400,000 Michiganders. And literally, if we don't do this, I mean, people could end up losing their lives because of having to rely on the ER too much or not be able to feel comfortable going there until it's too late. So we need to get this done.
Governor, how late is too late?
There's no specific date in terms of passing the legislation. The real key is we need to implement January 1 of 2014. So what I would, again, emphasize is the sooner the better in terms of there's a lot of hard work to be done. I'm ready to roll up my sleeves and do that hard work. And if we can get it done this summer, I feel confident we can get it done. If it gets to the fall, it may be questionable whether we can effectively implement in time.
I think I hear, and I think a lot of us do, we hear some exasperation and frustration in what you're saying about this. Governor, did you expect to have this much difficulty getting members of your own party on board with something that you, as governor, as a Republican governor, clearly feel is really, really important to Michigan?
Well, again, I don't view this as partisanship. I view this is just a common sense solution to help Michiganders. This is, again, better health care for people for a broken system. We have an unmanaged, uncontrolled system where people go to the ER. That's a crummy quality of life for them, and it costs Michiganders money because through higher insurance premiums. So I didn't look upon this as a partisan issue. I view this as, here's a problem that's been here for a lot of years. Here's our opportunity to solve it. Here's an opportunity to help our small business community. Here's an opportunity to help our healthcare community and do it in the context of a better state for all. So that's where I keep it simple, and I just want to get this done.
Governor, do you worry that this is going to keep action happening on other issues that are important in Michigan, in your view?
Yeah, it does make that more challenging because there are a number of other important things, including the whole issue of transportation funding. So that's sort of gotten put on the back burner as we work through this, because this is something that, with a very short timeline, that we need to get done. And the sooner we get it done, it means we can move back to working on other important issues that can be a positive impact on Michigan. We're the comeback state. I just want to make sure we keep it up.
So what should we expect to see from you, Governor, in the next week or two?
Continuation of doing these conversations around the state. I've done them at multiple healthcare institutions. The response has been tremendous. I'm doing it with small business people, with patients and patient advocates. And to hear the stories of how they had to struggle with insurance or not having insurance, that really puts an emphasis on why this is so critical to get done. So I'm just going to keep that up. And I'm going to be out talking to the public. It's time to use the soapbox the governor has to say, let's move promptly, let's move efficiently, asking the public to contact their senators, and let's get this wrapped up.
Making the most of that bully pulpit.
Absolutely. It's the right time and the right issue, because this is, again, this is just something that's truly compelling, because, again, people have lost their lives because of a lack of health insurance, and this is an opportunity to solve that problem.
Governor Rick Snyder, thank you for talking with us today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
A federal judge in Detroit says a lesbian couple challenging Michigan's adoption laws and ban on same-sex marriage are entitled to their day in court. In his written order released today, Judge Bernard Friedman said April DeBoer and Jane Rouse have a plausible claim against the state, especially in light of last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision striking down the Defense of Marriage Act. The ruling said the federal law is unconstitutional because it relegates same-sex unions to second-tier status. The DeBoer and Rouse lawsuit says Michigan's adoption and marriage laws deny them and the three children they're raising equal protection under the law. The state says changes to Michigan's adoption and marriage laws should be done by the legislature and the voters, not by a judge. A procedural hearing is set for July 10th. Still to come, poet and writer Keith Taylor will stop by to share his summer reading picks. And then what it really means for our economy now that Michigan is number one in the nation for small business lending. That's in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, now that summer has truly taken us into her embrace, we've been thinking of some of our favorite summer pleasures. And it was fairly unanimous. One of the sweetest times of summer is lounging around in the sun, maybe on a beach, maybe your favorite spot on your back porch or your yard, and in your hands is a good book. Well, that's the cue to welcome Keith Taylor back to Stateside. Keith coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. He is a poet, he's a writer, and he is simply the best at uncovering hidden gems for us to read and enjoy. Welcome back, Keith Taylor.
It's good to be here, Cindy. Thanks.
So what have you brought us for our summer reading?
Well, I did a quirky list. There's those summer reading lists that everybody does, and there's an awful lot of overlap on them.
Yeah.
This year, there's a particular bunch of overlap. NPR list is the same as the New York Times list, which is the same as the AnnArbor.com list, or very close. So I thought I'd find some things that were a little bit different, a little bit out there. They're not going to fit everybody's image of a summer read, but some of them will appeal to some people, and I think those books will become important to those people.
Starting with
Matt Bell's In the House Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and the Woods.
Well, first of all, the title is wonderful.
A 12-word title. I think every beginning writer is told not to do that, but Matt Bell breaks the rules. As that title indicates, there's something about this book that is much more myth than anything we might easily label reality. Here, the author is making some demands on the reader, and many readers, you know, particularly in July, might not want to submit to those demands. You don't read this book to escape.
Yeah.
Those readers who get there, those readers who are hooked, and they'll probably be hooked by the first page, they'll be drawn into this strange dreamscape where neither the characters nor the locations have names. People build their houses by singing them into existence, and outside are damaged bears haunting the night and living deep in caves where even the people must go to survive. Hmm. Animals transform into people and people into animals.
This sounds like Game of Thrones.
It does a little bit. It does a little bit, except Game of Thrones is more realistic than this one.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a stretch.
I'm thinking of the wargs.
Right. Matt Bell has constructed his dreamscape where everything feels like metaphor. Although the readers, or at least this reader, is never quite actually sure what the metaphor is meant to describe. There's certainly something about childlessness and the effects of infertility on a couple that desperately wants children. That's there.
Okay.
But there's also this meditation on memory, how it works, and how it generates language. And there's something about our relationship with nature itself.
It does sound like one of the most complex books that you've ever shared with us.
I think it might be. It might be. You got to make some demands. And again, I don't want to use the word there will be a cult following on this book,
okay,
but I'm going to bet. Huh. I'll bet you that there will be. The right readers are going to relish absolutely every word of it. But listen to this. It's early on where the narrator first sees the bear. The day before I carried my wife into our house, the other reason she was in my arms, the the first time I spied the bear watching me from within its woods. And when I saw it, I stilled my work upon the dirt, moved slowly to set down the tools with which I'd not quite completed the house. At the tree line that marked the edge of the woods, the giant bear's back hackled, increased its size again, and the wedge of its head swayed huge and square from its massive shoulders, its mouth spilling yellowed teeth and lolling tongue, exhalations steaming the morning chill. In the face of its stare, I stared back, and the bear slavered in response, shook its thick fur as welcome or warning, and when it saw it had my attention, it stood on its huge hind legs, its stamping body, a dark tower opening to push a roar up toward the heavens, toward the sun that in those days still ran full circle. Imagine that while you're sitting late at night in your cabin alone by the woods.
Drawing the curtains.
That's right. Yeah, it's not easy stuff.
And tell us a little about Matt Bell.
Matt Bell, he's a Michigan boy, actually. Mm-hmm. Two of my authors this time are Michigan people. Matt's a young writer. He's written a collection of short stories and one even odder novella, which I liked quite a bit. He's from a little town outside Saginaw. Hemlock, I think, is the town he's from. Matt is an incredible presence on the internet. He has in many ways created his life on the internet. He's the editor of a wonderful online journal called The Collagist, thecollagist.com, and he's now teaching at Northern Michigan University. He's really created a life for himself doing this very quirky fiction.
When you say the right reader, who is the right reader for this?
Who is the right reader for this? This is a reader who is going to enjoy books by Samuel Beckett, who's going to enjoy books by Italo Calvino, books that are built on dreamscapes, books that create their own landscapes.
Okay.
And there's a lot of those people out there. Beckett won the Nobel, after all.
Sure.
But it's not the usual thing we think of. It's not a John le Carré page-turner for the summer, although I love John le Carré page-turners, but this is different.
And the title again is?
Oh, these wonderful 12 words.
Yeah.
In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods.
That's our first choice from Keith Taylor.
Now, the second one's quite a bit different, still kind of odd, but very different in mood. Amy Leach's The Things That Are. If you have to categorize this book, you can categorize it simply as a collection of nature essays. And in many ways, that explanation is right. Amy Leach looks closely at the things of this world, peas, whirligig beetles, moths, lilies, or goats, among a host of other things. And she learns a lot about them. And then she communicates what she has learned. So that says one thing about the book, but it doesn't capture the flavor of Things That Are. Amy Leach has an imagination that transforms things, and she finds words and phrases that change them too. When I read some of the words she uses, I assumed I was finding even more gaps in my faulty education until I tried to look them up, and they weren't there either. Often these words she invents are very funny. Often they seem to capture something essential. She can indeed be funny, but she can also be quietly kind of wise. And she's a young woman. This is a first book. The world becomes a metaphor in these essays, a way to understand connections and emotional states we might not be able to understand otherwise. So I just want to give you a flavor. This is the very end of a really beautiful essay called The Wine of Astonishment. It starts out being an essay about whirligig beetles moving across the surface of a pond.
Okay.
Near the end, she describes the things that sink into the mud during winter. As summer approaches, these creatures rise to the surface. There's one more thing to consider in identifying a creature, and that is the season. Some of the animals in the mud belong in the mud. Some are just holding their horses. Best to wait until the vernal equinox to decide who someone is. After sun crosses equator and rain softens ground and warmth splinters ice and impassiveness, and up from the mud bed swim the shiny black beetles, up through the murky pond and onto its gleaming surface. Turning ice into water is like turning water into wine. After that many months of mud, whirling on the starry-eyed water must feel like drinking the wine of astonishment.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that pretty?
Yes, it is. It's very, very pretty. Very pretty. So these are essays?
These are essays, and they often start out about one thing and end up being about something else. She does away, she projects herself into the minds of these critters. whirligig beetles, which seem like that's going to be terribly hokey. But that last sentence.
Well, when I think of Van Morrow Lindbergh.
Exactly. Same kind of thing. That
same
that tradition.
Yeah. The Gifts from the Sea. All right. Where you're studying shells and
good
seeing...
job. Yes.
Oh, thank
yes.
you.
It's a beautiful book, and it's a little obscure. It's from an obscure press called Milkweed, or a more obscure press called Milkweed Editions from Minneapolis. I didn't know about it. A friend wanted me to read it. His name is Ray McDaniel. He's a wonderful poet. He wanted me to read it so badly that he bought me a copy.
Well, that means he did.
You know, and
now,
he was right.
What do you know about Amy Leach?
Not much.
Not much.
She, I think, although there's so much northern stuff in here, that she must be the northern Midwest somewhere, did an MFA in nonfiction at the University of Iowa, has a young child, and that's almost all I know. She's won some big awards for people before the book came out, so she's on her way.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are exploring a summer reading list put together by our friend Keith Taylor. He is a poet and a writer, and we have him every season to kind of find some uncovered gems for us to enjoy and read. So we've gone through Matt Bell's In the House, Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and the Woods, Amy Leach's The Things That Are, and now we move on to
A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. Another lovely title, isn't it?
Yes. It's
This actually comes from a medical book. So I think, if I remember it correctly, where it pops up in the novel, that's the definition of life,
okay.
A constellation of vital phenomena.
Wow.
This book actually does appear on a couple of other summer reading lists. It is closer to the kind of book one expects on a summer reading list.
Okay.
It's a first novel. Again, a young author. He worked a decade on this book. And it's really interesting. Until the attacks at the Boston Marathon, I think most of us probably never thought much about that little region in southern Russia known as Chechnya.
Correct.
The Chechens themselves think of it as a country, and that's the problem they
yes.
have to deal with. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, most of them wanted autonomy, but the Russians weren't going to allow that. Mm-hmm. I think it's a necessary place to carry oil from one part to the other.
There's a good economic reason they
right.
wouldn't let it go, yes.
So two brutal wars followed, one in 1994 and the other in 2004. Millions of people were displaced, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands killed in that particularly brutal way we seem to have mastered recently in our ethnic wars.
Yes.
People waited for the knock on the door and then disappeared forever. Now, Anthony Mara is a young man, and he did his study abroad in Russia, where he was overwhelmed with news about the Chechen wars. Then he spent several years researching them, went to Chechnya, and then he spent all of his time writing his novel. He created a little village outside the city of Volchansk, which I'd never heard of and had to look up. That one's real. And he populated his village with the people who've survived for much of the Second War. Friends have learned to mistrust friends, and people have learned to commit the worst of betrayals just so they can survive.
Mm.
Still, one man, Ahmed, chooses to risk his own well-being, even his life, to protect Hava, the young daughter of his vanished friend and neighbor. He enlists the unwitting help of Sonia, the last Russian doctor in the city. So Mara's blending all these different ethnicities, too, which is interesting. Together, these three small people find a way to survive the horrors around them. I can't say that they triumph, but perhaps survival itself is enough. Mara's great at describing the place and the devastation and creates genuinely vivid characters. I was completely drawn in and was left rather wonderfully devastated at the end. If you feel the need to read for a good cry, your cathartic cry.
Oh, boy. This
book
is the one, huh?
This will do it. Here's a little point near the end of the book, actually. So listen to how well he describes the scene, just in two tiny short paragraphs. Here's Sonia, the doctor, walking through the blasted streets with the little girl, making a tentative move toward hope. A half hour later, they left the hospital, block after block passed unchanged, but for the location of craters, the dispersion of brick. A one-way sign pointed to the sky. Three emaciated black dogs watched them from across the canyon of a grocery store basement, and thankfully didn't follow. All through it, Sonia's head hummed. She held the girl's suitcase in one hand and her hand in the other. She tried to remember the name of the street she had lived on. This is what there is. Scorch marks fanning like massive seashells across the ground, clouds gathering at the horizon, the unevenness of earth, the small heat she holds in her hand, a hand that is her hand, holding a hand that is the girl's hand. This is it.
Ooh.
this is the kind of thing we can get from novels. We can get our history lessons from novels
yes.
when they're done and when they're done well. And maybe that's a way we need to do it, to connect with these, connect empathetically with these people who are out there who are experiencing things that we're not feeling.
Oh,
exactly. Yes, and we're drawn in. Anthony Mara, M-A-R-R-A, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. Wonderful young writer. We're going to hear a lot from him, I think.
And next up.
Next up, I wanted to end with one poem. I always like to end with a poem. Last year, the United States Post Office had some commemorative stamps of 20th century poets. There were 10 poets on there. I don't want to sound too regionally chauvinistic, but two of those poets were from Michigan.
We love that.
Exactly. One was Theodore Retke, who we talked about in the spring.
Yes.
The other one was Robert Hayden. Hayden is maybe a little bit less well-known now. He was born in Detroit in 1913. He studied at Wayne State and then at U of M. Most of his professional life was at Fisk University, and then he returned to the University of Michigan for the last 10 years of his life. He died in 1980, buried out in the northeast corner of Ann Arbor. Hayden wrote many things, and often about African-American history. He has extraordinary poems about the slave trade, Frederick Douglass, and Nat Turner. But some of his loveliest poems are memories of the African-American neighborhood called Paradise Valley in Detroit, where he grew up. Here's a summer memory. The old poet looks back at Detroit circa 1920 and remembers his boyhood, some of the good, some of the bad. The title calls up that phrase from the Gershwin song, Summertime and the Living is Easy.
Yes, yes.
But the Hayden title is just Summertime and the Living, dot, dot, dot. So here's a poem. Here's Robert Hayden, Summertime and the Living. Nobody planted roses, he recalls, but sunflowers gangled there sometimes, tough-stalked and bold, and like the vivid children there unplanned. Their circus poster horses curveted in trees of heaven above the quarrels and shattered glass, and he was bareback rider of them all. No roses there in summer, oh, never roses, except when people died, and no vacations for his elders, so harshened after each unrelenting day that they were shouting angry. But summer was, they said, the poor folks' time of year. And he remembers how they would sit on the broken steps amid the fevered tossings of the dusk, the dark, wafting hearsay with funeral parlor fans or making evening solemn by their quietness. Feels their mosaic eyes upon him, though the florist roses that only sorrow could afford long since have bidden them Godspeed. Oh, summer, summer, summertime. Then grim street preachers shook their tambourines and Bibles in the face of tolerant wickedness. Then Elks parades and big, splendiferous Jack Johnson in his diamond limousine set the ghetto burgeoning with fantasies of Ethiopia spreading her gorgeous wings.
Well, beautiful.
Robert Hayden. His collected poems is just, there's a new edition of it out in paperback. So
very, very good. Yeah. What do you think, Keith, that the books you've chosen, what does it say to you about what summertime in Michigan means?
Oh, boy. What summertime in Michigan means to me, I mean, I spend the summers up north, although not this year. I canoe, I walk in the woods, I do all those things, and that these books are, and other than the Amy Leach book, these books are a contrast to that, which is interesting. And maybe that says more about me than it says about the season. But I was looking for the contrast. I have a lot of time. I have more time in the summer. I can read some of these things that might be more difficult to read when I'm working 15-hour days or have hour commutes. Maybe that's why I like this particular kind of book that makes puts some demands on me. And I know I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone. I know there are people who save their summers for the hardest books on their list. Not that these books are hard. These books are all pretty engaging. But
with great demands come.
They make demands.
Great rewards.
Exactly. Sometimes. Let's hope.
Oh, let's hope. Poet and writer Keith Taylor, he coordinates the undergrad program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. And get the fall reading list ready.
Okay.
Keith, we will
see
you for our fall list.
I'll do it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come. As 4th of July celebrations come near at hand, we begin our week-long series hearing from immigrants about what America means to them. That comes up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is number one in the nation for loans being issued to small businesses. It turns out the Small Business Administration's Michigan district backed 1,221 loans to the tune of nearly $344 million, and that was in the first 8 months of this fiscal year. That puts the SBA's Michigan District Office right at the top of the national heap in terms of 7A lending. Now, the 7A loan is the SBA's flagship lending program. It provides banks a guarantee of 50 to 90% on small business loans. David Sowerby is an economist with Loomis Sayles in Bloomfield Hills, where he joins us from. Hello, David.
Good afternoon, Cindy.
Why is it that Michigan is number one in small business loans? What's happening here?
I think there are two factors. First, we know that there's been a absolute cyclical rebound for the state in the last three-plus years. Michigan has been one of the faster-growing states when it comes to manufacturing job growth, when it comes to decline in the unemployment rate compared to other states. When I look at Michigan simply and add together job growth plus income growth, and combine the two and call it prosperity. On a prosperity measure, Michigan has been outpacing the U.S. for the last 3 years. And then the second factor is that I think the banks have become more friendly, more receptive to the long-term potential for Michigan, and the combination of the two has led to Michigan being number one in small business lending.
Now, when you talk about that prosperity calculation, Is the fact that Michigan's got this rate of growth because things were so bad that any improvement looks huge?
That is certainly the case. If you look at just how difficult it was for the state, not simply in the 2008-2009 recession, but going back for the last 12 or 13 years, mm-hmm. that Michigan was consistently underperforming the country for job and income growth. And then along comes the Great Recession, and we get hit very hard. Coming out of that, Michigan has certainly improved from the very low levels. That's been a contributing factor. Now, I think encouragingly, we've put together more secular or structural opportunities for Michigan that I think give us the better potential to win over the next 5 to 10 years that go beyond simply a cyclical rebound from depressed levels.
Now, when you talk about cyclical rebound, what that tells me is that what we've been through, as tough as it is, is it just part of the economic life cycle in Michigan?
We know from looking at the Michigan economy, whether it's 20 years, 50 years, or longer, that we do suffer more in recessions than the rest of the country does because of our greater reliance on more cyclical industries, such as the motor vehicle industry. That's always been the case. There was certainly the case in the 1990s when Michigan enjoyed, I think, very good excess return or outperformance compared to the U.S. But when you look over a 50-year cycle, when times are good coming out of recessions, we do better. When we go into recessions, unfortunately, we get hit harder. That's the natural pro-cyclicality of Michigan business.
All right, let's drill down into this small business activity. What does it really mean that lenders are so clearly open to the needs of small businesses in Michigan, clearly with some hand-holding from the Small Business Administration?
Well, I wouldn't declare victory yet, but I think it's a more compelling sign that when you get into the weeds, that a more greater number of financial institutions have said that they see longer-term potential in Michigan, whether it's the east side of the state and its manufacturing bias to a still very untold story for what's taken place on the west side of the state with very meaningful growth rates in the Grand Rapids area and beyond. That's been very compelling. So the more opportunistic lenders have said, we believe in Michigan's opportunity structurally over the longer term, and we're going to commit to it. And that's essential because small business needs capital to grow and to flourish. And without that capital, whether it's from the banking industry or it could be from alternative financing measures. You simply have to have capital availability to get growth off the floor, to see fledgling companies get the opportunity to grow.
It's the lifeblood.
It is. It's the lifeblood, along with backing it up with sales, revenue, profits, cash flow. That's the byproduct of I think lending based on, you know, does this company have smart management? Does it have a business model that fits? Is it going to grow? It's simply not always the financials, but belief that management is going to take it to a higher level. Because anytime you're a lender, whether you're a bond investor or a bank lender, you name it, you want to get paid back, and you need to be paid back on these loans, and that's, I think, where we're seeing more risk and entrepreneurial taking in Michigan is in small business lending.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty speaking with David Sowerby, who's an economist with Loomis Sayles in Bloomfield Hills, as we look at the fact that Michigan is number one in the nation for loans being issued to small businesses. And that comes from the Small Business Administration's Michigan District, top of the heap in the nation in terms of backing loans to small businesses. David, who is getting the money? What kinds of businesses? Does it go beyond manufacturing and autos?
It certainly goes beyond manufacturing and autos too. You know, in any industry, life sciences, could be in the food industry. It could be across the board. You know, we've seen business services begin to recover. There's certainly areas where Michigan needs to compete better. I think in the financial service industry, Michigan has seen a more secular decline over the last 20 plus years. That has to improve. While manufacturing is doing much better, I think construction has been lagging, particularly not residential construction, but on the commercial and in the industrial side. So those are still areas that I think Michigan needs to see a continuation of what good has happened in motor vehicles, what good has happened in health sciences, what good has happened with the universities prompting more entrepreneurial spirits, animal spirits, and that has to continue to improve. And frankly, it just doesn't have to improve at the state setting the table right for businesses to do well, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say I do get disappointed at what our federal government does to sometimes kill those animal spirits in the form of either direct taxation or indirect taxation via regulation.
Yeah, because I wanted your thoughts on what needed to happen on a state and a national level to help our recovery along.
Well, the state has done the right thing, I think, by reforming the corporate income tax. And Michigan is a top 20 states in business competitiveness. That's not my opinion. It's from the Tax Foundation. Other organizations, too, rank Michigan quite well on the competitiveness side. I think that the improvements we've made to more certainty on the corporate income tax has done Michigan wonders for the long-term potential. Yet at the same time, I look at the federal government in Washington and just shake my head and think you can do better. You can do better for your citizens. You can do better for business.
David, is there any downside or risk in making so many loans to small businesses?
It's simply if you don't get paid back.
Okay.
Pretty basic, but we saw in 2005, 2006, 2007 with the most recent classic example in the housing industry that there were loans made based on unsound or less than favorable financials. I think we've learned our lesson, hopefully, that, you know, that good, sound, but still, you know, measured risk in business lending will be rewarded.
So based on what we're talking about, what would you tell someone listening to us right now who has a small business or harbors the dream to have a small business?
Don't let the federal government diminish your animal spirits and your entrepreneurial activity. I can tell you as a economist slash portfolio manager, the people I work with the most are the people who at certain points in their time recognize that there's risk in not taking risk and the ability to start your own business, work hard, do well by your customers, do it for that reason, not for any monetary gain, and you will win. That simple.
Economist and portfolio manager David Sowerby. He's with Loomis Sayles, and he spoke to us today from their office in Bloomfield Hills. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Cindy.
As the 4th of July draws near, we begin a week-long series of stories here on Stateside. We'll hear from immigrants about what America means to them. Today's story comes from a young woman who lives at the Salvation Army's Teen Parent Center in Grand Rapids. The Salvation Army has asked us not to use her name or the name of her one-year-old son.
I am 17 now, and I was born in Mexico. I came to America illegally. My mom brought us when we were 8, me and my brother. And we crossed the border. We walked over here, basically. And we just walked for hours and hours. And a car would pick us up, drive us somewhere, drop us off. Then we would walk again. We got to a place. It was too crowded. We moved to another one. Then we moved to another one. And came over here to Grand Rapids. He's tired. He was born February 5th, 2012. He's what made me stay in the U.S. If I would have never got pregnant, I would have left with my mom to Mexico. But having a kid, I wasn't going to be able to do it over there. In Mexico, it's way harder. Like, economy-wise, it's not good. It's dangerous. I don't see a good future for him over there. What America means to me, I really haven't thought about it really. I just think of it of there's so much you can accomplish here. And I like it here, but I have lots of respect for my country. I guess because I know more of the history of it. So I don't think I'll ever call myself American.
That was the voice of a young Mexican-American mom living at the Teen Parent Center in Grand Rapids. She's one of hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States under the Deferred Action Immigration Program, approved last year by President Obama. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Making the world better, one piece of pie at a time. You could say that's the mission behind a project called Pie It Forward. Sarah Fertig says she's on a mission to change the world with the power of pie. Sarah and her boyfriend Chris left their homes in Brighton, packed up their 1999 Silverado, whose name, by the way, is Gracie, and along with their border collie co-pilot, the pair have been crisscrossing the nation, baking pies and handing out free slices. We wondered about this mission and just how one betters the world with pie. So we caught up with Sarah Fertig. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
Where are you and Chris making pie these days?
We just completed our 17th event. We're in Oklahoma City this week, and we're going to be leaving Oklahoma later today and heading towards Dallas.
Now, what launched Pie It Forward, which I just love the name. It was Occupy, but I think Pie It Forward is awesome. Why walk away from the lives you had here in Michigan?
Well, we started Pie It Forward in Michigan. We gave away free pie in Ann Arbor last year from July to November. We were out there for 18 weeks. But we loved the project so much that we decided we wanted to take our message on the road to a wider audience.
And the message is?
Be kind, share more, be more generous, and make pie.
And make pie. What is it about pie? Why is it such a catalyst for happiness?
Well, the pie is very iconic, but the pie is a metaphor. I was inspired originally by now Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts by her factory speech, where she said, if you built a factory and you got rich, that's great, but you also had workers that other people educated and roads that other people built and police and firefighters. So you have to pay back into the system that helped create your success. I took her metaphor and I made it about pie so that it was even easier to understand.
I baked the pie, and I worked really hard on it, but I didn't plant the apple trees, I didn't milk the cow, I didn't churn the butter, I didn't plant the wheat field. So how can I claim that just because I assembled it, it's mine, all mine, and no one else can have any?
And what kind of reaction do you get? Do you set up in a public place and here you and Chris are with a smile and a free slice?
Exactly. People are usually a bit skeptical at first. I guess free food is kind of unusual no matter what kind of food it is.
True.
But then we generally win over the crowd, and the pie can be gone in anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour.
And what are you learning about people, Sarah Fertig, as you are crisscrossing the country and you're handing out pie with Pie It Forward? What have you learned about people and about living on the road?
Well, we've learned that people from one side of the country to the other are more similar than different. Everybody has the same set of concerns, whether it's, you know, city or country, north or south, red state or blue state. Everybody wants a safe place to lay their head at night, wants to make sure their families and their children are taken care of. They want good food, they want companionship, they want friendship and good neighbors and safety. That's a universal, and it's been really cool to see that everywhere we go.
What do you hope that the rest of us will learn from what you and Chris are doing?
Well, what we really want to show people is that sharing and giving is not scary, and that no one is going to wind up in a cardboard box because they, you know, because they shared, whether it's giving a few dollars to a homeless person on the street or setting aside one afternoon a week to volunteer or in whatever capacity people can share. We're just trying to get people over that fear. You know, our path is pretty extreme, but there are several less extreme options that a person could take.
So, Sarah, as you go across the country, is there one kind of pie over another that gets the best response from people?
Well, I mean, we typically make apple pies the most because that's our specialty and it's the metaphor. But the peach pie that we made in Nashville, those seem to go over really well. And in Memphis, sort of inspired by Elvis, we made a peanut butter cream pie. And I'd never made a cream pie before, but it was apparently really good. The crowd loved it.
Sarah Fertig, on her blog, Pie It Forward, she describes herself as executive weirdo do-gooder, primary driver, and blogger. Her boyfriend, Chris, recently promoted to vice weirdo do-gooder, boyfriend and baking assistant, along with being primary navigator and secondary driver. How long will we be on the road?
We've got about 4 more months to go. We've got events planned every Wednesday and Saturday from now through mid-October.
You can follow their travels as they try to change the world through the power of pie. Just go to pieitforward.wordpress.com. Sarah, happy pieing.
Thank you so much.
My position is tragic. Come and show me the magic of your Hollywood song. Now, honey pie, you were driving me frantic.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. We'll be right back.